This is the English Heritage Podcast.
Hello, and thanks for joining us for your weekly podcast, Into England's Past. I'm Charles Rowe. This week we're focusing on one of the most powerful and controversial men in 1300s England. Thomas, Earl of Lancaster, was the creator of Dunstanborough Castle, on a remote headland on the Northumberland coast. But while it was a great feat of construction, given its size and impressive position, it also reflected the divisions between him and his cousin, King Edward II. What we're about to hear is a tale of power, intrigue, possible forbidden love, and executions right at the heart of the establishment. And joining us to explain all is Head Historic Properties Curator, Dr. Jeremy Ashby.
Hi, Charles. It's lovely to be back with you today.
This is a really exciting prospect, I think, this one, isn't it? A dramatic story, one of those almost Game of Thrones scenarios that we've discussed before. Can you start by describing Dunstanborough Castle, which I know is one of your favourite ruins, and what visitors today will see there?
Dunstanborough Castle is wild and lonely. I think those are the two words that I'd have to use to describe it, and everyone will really have to go and see it for themselves. It's on the North Sea coast of Northumberland, north of Newcastle. It's between Newcastle and Berwick-on-Tweed. Many people will have to get there by driving. You'll drive up the A1, or you'll get a train to Alnmouth. And from there, you have to go east towards the sea. But interestingly, Dunstanborough Castle is one of the very few places that we get to that you can't drive all the way to. You actually are going to have to get out and walk over 2 miles. And I think it's probably the English Heritage Site that's furthest from the public road. That was one of the things I first fell in love with about the site, that actually in those 2 miles, you really do get to look at the ruins, which are, as said in podcasts before, excitingly jagged. And you think about their history. And all this time, the weather quite often is doing extraordinary things at you. You can hear the crashing of the waves. The wind is blowing in from the sea. It really is the most dramatic location that you can imagine. And the site of Dunstanborough itself, though very heavily ruined, it's instantly evocative of an ancient and mysterious history. And that's the history of Thomas of Lancaster that we're going to be talking about today.
Yes, we'll get into that mystery a little bit later as well. But the ruined castle was captured a few times by a famous English artist. And when I say captured, not actually stormed, I mean actually painted. Who's that?
This is J.M.W. Turner, who painted quite a lot of castles in Britain and a number of ones that we have. But I think Dunstanborough really particularly appealed to him because as well as the landscape and the ruin itself, famously, Turner does weather and he does sea and he does all of those things, and they're in very rich supply at Dunstanborough. So he painted it several times. There are a number of his depictions of it. In particular, I mean, he just captured that you cannot avoid the fact that this is a site of great drama, and it was a perfect subject for him, and he really nailed it.
Do you think he was fully aware of the backstory of Thomas, Earl of Lancaster, as he was painting these dramatic pictures?
I am absolutely certain he was not. I think this is actually quite an obscure story. And I say this now to all listeners who are thinking, who are we talking about? This is another one of those podcasts where we're going to talk about someone who in their time was very famous, but is now pretty obscure. Thomas of Lancaster, I suppose, if he has any kind of public profile at all, for people who have seen the play by Christopher Marlowe, Edward II, but even in that, Thomas of Lancaster sort of appears as one of a whole number of barons in the play. He's not one of the leading characters. But in his time, he's a very, very big personality, as we'll be saying. He's a leader of politics, the owner of huge swathes of England, and a whole number of castles. And Dunstanborough, that we're going to be talking about principally today, I think is one of the greatest legacies that he's left. But actually, he had an involvement in a whole number of other sites that we look after. So Pickering Castle and Kenilworth Castle, they have offstage roles in this story.
Where's Pickering?
Pickering's in Yorkshire. It's to the northeast of York. And Kenilworth, as everyone knows, is in the right in the middle of England. It's in Warwickshire. So it's near Warwick and Coventry.
So we're talking obviously about Thomas Earl of Lancaster. He's the creator of Dunstanborough Castle. That's one of his key points on his CV, so to speak. But he's also King Edward II's cousin. So can you tell us a bit more about that dynamic?
Thomas of Lancaster, he's very, very highly born. His father was Edmund, Earl of Lancaster, sometimes known as Edmund Crouchback, which is very evocative, but it's not that he's got a hunchback. It's actually that he wore a cross on his back like a crusader. Edmund Crouchback was the son of King Henry III, the King of England. Edmund Crouchback was also married to a Dowager Queen of Navarre. So both Thomas's father and mother are royal. So that makes Thomas the nephew of King Edward I, but it also makes him the cousin of Edward I's son, Edward II, who's a very important part of this story. So he's a part of the royal family, but not actually in the line of succession. And I think one thing I should say now in this Game of Thrones is I don't think Thomas ever imagined, and I don't think any of his supporters ever imagined, that he would sit on the throne. That's not what this is about. But what this is about is a very, very powerful nobleman trying to look after himself and other powerful noblemen.
Interesting. So when he knows Edward II isn't yet Edward II. He is the future Edward II.
That's right. The hints are that he was born around 1278. His childhood is pretty obscure as well. So it was really only when he's about 16 or 17 that we first start to hear anything about him, when his family set up a marriage to a very, very wealthy heiress, the daughter of the Earl of Lincoln. That's important because though Thomas would have been wealthy already, this makes him very, very wealthy. He's the heir to a huge estate, particularly in the Midlands. We know that by the age of about 19 or 20, so we're talking about the late 1290s, Thomas is doing what everyone would expect him to do. He joins Edward I's army and they go off to fight in Scotland. And one of the things that we know about him is that he's reasonably close to his cousin, Edward of Carnarvon, who is the crown prince of England. He's the person who's going to become Edward II. The two of them seem to be quite fond of one another. And Uncle Edward I also seems to like the cut of Thomas's jib. He's impressed by Thomas's evident military bearing. And there's one anecdote that's particularly impressed modern historians, which is that Edward thought that Thomas was a jolly good thing and actually drew a contrast between him and his own son, Edward of Carnarvon, who was apparently a bit less warlike. Now, how much you might read into that remains to be seen, because, of course, it colours pretty much everything that we see thereafter. But certainly this feeling that at the time everything is really quite happy and that Thomas is an entirely admirable figure and someone actually who's a good model for the conduct of a future King of England. But basically, there is a great mystery about Edward II, particularly his relationship with a man, Piers Gaveston. This relationship has gone down in history as probably the most famous example of a gay or homosexual relationship in pretty well the whole of medieval English history, that Thomas and Piers Gaveston were lovers. Very clearly, their relationship was a very close and loving one, that it was the closest relationship, certainly, that Edward had with anyone in his life. But it's slightly mysterious because, I mean, actually, contemporaries, while they write about the love of Edward II for this man as being immoderate or unseemly, they don't ever actually go all the way to say that it was a homosexual relationship. Certainly, if they were gay, both of them were married, both of them had children. So, you know, it's a little bit unclear.
Did they get on well as teenagers? Do we know much about their relationship, Thomas and Edward?
They do seem to be close. And that it's only actually after Edward II becomes king that they drift apart. And it really does seem to be a drift apart rather than a big bust up. But I think it's fairly clear that the key to the problem was when Edward II became king, Piers Gaveston came to greater and greater prominence. Now, as I've said, Piers Gaveston was Edward II's closest intimate, and that much is certain. Whether or not their relationship was a sexual one, and it might well have been, or whether, as some modern historians have suggested, that they'd entered into some kind of
pact,
social compact, like brotherhood or some adoptive brotherhood or something else of that kind. The jury really does seem to be still out about this. But the important thing about Pierce is that he wasn't born to the top level of society. He actually wasn't even English. His ancestry was from Gascony, and he comes from a gentry family, a family of knights. But he has come to England, and he is one of the entourage around the prince, Edward II. He's another one who's fighting in Edward's wars in Scotland, and seems, at least at the beginning of times, to actually be regarded as quite a good thing. May even have been selected by Edward I as, like Thomas, as a good role model for the prince, for the future Edward II. He, however, starts, and this went on for the rest of his life, he dabbles in politics. And if you're lowly born, that's quite a dangerous thing to do. You're going to make powerful enemies. That certainly seems to have been something of a talent of Pierce Gaveston. So one of the first people that he annoys, and this is still, you know, while Edward I is still alive, he annoys Edward I by, when he's supposed to be fighting in Scotland, he goes off with a whole load of other knights on a tournament. And this is regarded by Edward I as desertion. And while Edward I actually pardons them, one of the punishments around this time is that Gaveston is sent away from England into exile. Now, this is something that's going to happen to Pierce three times in his life and his career. And we don't know exactly why it was. One possibility is that Edward I actually was trying to impress himself more on Prince Edward by sending his close friend away into exile. But certainly for that exile, which is happening in 1307, so it's the last year of Edward I's life, the expectation is that Pierce is going to go away into exile, but he's still actually receiving some money from the royal court. And the expectation is that at a certain moment, Edward I will call for him to come back. The big change is when Edward I dies. When that happens, Edward II becomes king. And at that moment, suddenly Pierce Gaveston, his social status rockets. He is brought back from exile. Very quickly and very significantly, he receives nobility, and not just any old nobility. He's given the Earldom of Cornwall. This makes him disgustingly wealthy, because the Earldom of Cornwall owns tin mines. And so all the proceeds of the lands of the Earldom of Cornwall suddenly go to this upstart, Pierce Gaveston. And symbolism also matters. For example, at Edward II's coronation, Pierce Gaveston gets to play a prominent role. He gets to carry the great sword, Curtana, in procession. And he wears very extravagant and elaborate clothes on this occasion. And the outcome of all of this is that all the established nobility think, hang on, that really ought to be me. Who is this ghastly person? And at that point, enmity starts to grow up between the old nobles and this new young upstart favorite of the king. And one of the most important people who's opposing Pierce Gaveston is Thomas, Earl of Lancaster.
Was Pierce Gaveston also favored by Edward I, Edward II's father?
Yes, initially he was, actually. Edward I seems initially to have liked the look of Pierce Gaveston. And it's only really towards the end of his life that relationship between the old king and the young companion of his son starts to go a bit sour.
It surprises me that someone who's been exiled for being naughty and basically going off with his friends to a tournament on horseback when he should have been fighting a battle, I'm surprised that he was even rewarded with any nobility. But I suppose that's cronyism in the Middle Ages, isn't it?
I think that's right. And I think what it just shows is that Edward II really didn't have any truck with what his father had been saying or doing at the end of his life. The old king was dead. The new king was in. I'm bringing my good friend back. I'm going to give him these amazing perks that I can. I'm going to shower honours upon him. It's something that some kings do, but of course it's a dangerous thing to do if you're a king, to take favourites, if that seems to be cutting out a whole load of other people. And one thing that I think is clear about all of this is that Piers's natural bearing and manner, He's an ambitious young man. He's a young man on the make. And very clearly, that nettled quite a lot of people. One of the chroniclers at the time, who's generally fairly sympathetic, says, "I therefore believe firmly maintained that if Piers had from the outset borne himself prudently and humbly towards the magnates of the land, none of them would have opposed him. But Piers did not bear himself prudently and humbly toward the magnates of the land. One of the things that we know about them is that he actually used to make up offensive nicknames about them. Thomas of Lancaster he called Churl. Another one of the earls he called Horse Son." Now, you can't do that kind of thing without really making waves. And that seems to have been the case, that these people not only objected to the principle that this upstart was being given promotions and had access to the king as his chief friend and counselor, and that meant that they didn't, but also, just to make matters worse, clearly he and the king were actually making fun of all these nobles, and that was a situation that was deeply intolerable.
Yes, that sounds like a sort of in-joke on a playground or something, isn't it? Sort of sniggering between each other.
Certainly desperately infantile, one would say, because the names are not particularly clever. Churl, you know, calling Thomas lowborn, which Thomas was not lowborn by any means.
Almost pot calling kettle black.
Well, indeed so. And I think that point must have registered with the nobles, because in the early years of Edward II's reign, certainly there's a lot of care to try to sort this out. Government is clearly going to pot, and all the dissatisfactions around the king, for better or for worse, are being focused around this intolerable figure of the king's favourite and possibly lover, Piers Gaveston. Now, I mean, actually, some of the things that they were complaining about really didn't have a great deal to do with Piers. There's this issue called purveyance, which is regarded as a great injustice, that the royals can sort of dip their hand into various other people's pockets, claiming that more money and more resources are needed for the good of the kingdom. That's one of the major points of complaint, that Thomas becomes the head of a powerful faction of nobility who insist to Edward II that reform of government is needed. And that takes the form of what are called the ordinances. Basically, it's actually just, you know, a new set of rules of how the household and its finances will work. But this party under Thomas becomes known as the Lord's Ordainer, and they become just the latest in a long line going back earlier in history of times where there have been movements to try to get royals to actually moderate their demands and actually their authority. Not exactly democracy, but there should be a bit more representation about it. There should be, you know, before the king acts unilaterally, he should actually consult properly with a wide range of his counselors and noblemen. And obviously Thomas expects that he will be an important figure in the court at that time.
So where are we at this point?
We've now come into the second decade of the 14th century. So Edward I dies in 1307 and Edward II becomes king. Piers Gaveston comes back from exile immediately around then. The ordinances are happening around 1310 and 1311, 1312. These are years of mounting tension. Now, I would have to say that the second decade of the 14th century is really not at all a good time to be alive. While it doesn't have the Black Death, it has pretty much everything else. There's tension within the kingdom between the king and various of his nobility. The Scots have not been beaten by Edward I. They are rallying under Robert Bruce and, you know, are looking increasingly threatening to the stability and security of Northern England. And the weather is terrible and the harvests in the middle of that decade are really, really bad. So there isn't actually a great deal at this time to be cheerful about. And this mounting opposition between Edward II and the barons under Thomas come to a head in 1312, where it all breaks out into violence. Now, Piers Gaveston, at some point, had actually gone away briefly into exile abroad, but he's come back controversially to England. He and Edward II have spent Christmas 1311 together. Thomas is insistent that he's going to have to get rid of Piers Gaveston for good this time and to restore good government and the kingdom. The Archbishop of Canterbury and the church are with Thomas at this point. The Archbishop is one of Thomas's cronies, Thomas Winchelsey. He excommunicates Piers Gaveston. That's to say, Piers Gaveston is now cut off from the church. He's not allowed to take Holy Communion or anything like that, which is a very important thing. And Thomas and his barons move against Piers and the king, who at this moment are in the north of England. They get holed up in Scarborough Castle, another one of ours. It's a royal castle, so it belongs to Edward II. And Edward II, rather ungallantly, escapes from Scarborough Castle by sea on his own, leaving Piers Gaveston in Scarborough Castle to face the music. The barons under Thomas catch up with Piers Gaveston. A very tense negotiation takes place, at which eventually Piers says, okay, I will surrender to the barons. And they have given me their assurances that I will be treated well. They all start traveling towards the south, but on the way, as they're going through the Midlands, as it happens near Kenilworth, a hardline faction takes over Piers Gaveston. He is given what you must describe as a summary trial, but it doesn't really sort of amount to that, against charges, possibly coming back from exile when he shouldn't have done, or generally being regarded as a bad thing and against the ordinances that Thomas of Lancaster and his supporters had got the king to sign up to. But whatever the charges, Piers Gaveston is taken out and given a summary execution on the Earl of Lancaster's land near Kenilworth. He is beheaded.
And it's very interesting that it does happen near Kenilworth. You say it's a beheading. What kind? Are we talking about an axe or?
I think it's a sword, probably, but it's not a public thing. You know, there hasn't been due process. There hasn't been a trial. Thomas Lancaster seems not to have been there, but the Earl of Warwick might have been. And I think there are some anecdotal versions that say that Piers Gaveston's head was actually presented to the Earl of Warwick and the Earl of Lancaster. And I know certainly of one Victorian illustration that shows this grisly scene actually going on. Whatever happened, Thomas of Lancaster seems to have been regarded as having been complicit in Piers's death.
Mm.
Edward II was absolutely devastated by it. And certainly, initially, I think everyone believed that Edward II would harbour thoughts of revenge.
But did he? That's the question.
Initially, no. But it may well be that revenge is a dish best served cold, and that several years afterwards, that's actually what happened. I think it's fair to say that Edward II never forgave Thomas of Lancaster or any of the others for the death of Piers. But initially, he couldn't really do anything about it. They were actually just too powerful for him to do it. And indeed, in 1313, he actually goes through something of the charade of issuing a formal pardon to Thomas for the capture, detention, and the death of Piers, to Thomas and a whole number of others.
What's the motivation for giving that pardon then? Is it trying to just sort of quell the situation?
I suspect he felt an element of, you know, having been compelled to do it, that actually this baronial faction was just too powerful. But maybe it's some sense of clearing the air. I don't think anyone was terribly convinced by it, that actually that Edward had genuinely forgiven them and that he wouldn't take reprisals against them. And it is significant that it's at this point in history, 1312, 1313, the immediate aftermath of the death of Piers Gaveston, that Dunstanborough Castle finally enters our story.
And just before we get on to the construction of Dunstanborough Castle, Piers's death, it was effectively illegal, I'm presuming. It was a lawless beheading. It was just brutal, sort of severe one-upmanship.
It's very interesting that you use the word lawless. And this is a word that's going to come up again. Thomas, you know, regarded himself, often to a modern mind, he often seems to be taking, as it were, the moral high ground. And I suspect that Thomas felt that getting rid of this intolerable person was actually a way of restoring what should be good order, that a king should be consulting with the people who were born to advise the king. That is the highest status of nobility. But they didn't go through what you might regard as due process. It wasn't actually a proper judicial process. It was almost that. It had some of the trappings of it. And the execution of peers in private really was not the way that things should have been done, I think, at that time or anything. But the reality of it was that figures as powerful and as rich as Thomas of Lancaster or the Earl of Warwick actually could do pretty much what they liked. The shock is that they were able to do it to a figure so close to the King of England.
So we move on to the next stage of the story, which is the construction of Dunstanborough Castle. Thomas, Earl of Lancaster, obviously is its creator. How does the castle sort of fit into the development of the story from here? Because obviously Piers is out of the picture now, and it's almost, I suppose, Thomas versus the king.
Yes, right. Now, the most important thing, I think, to think about Dunstanborough Castle is it's a long way away from Westminster. It's a long way away from the south of England and the homeland of the king. And I'm absolutely certain that a great deal of why Thomas built himself a castle in this location at this time is to get as far away as possible from Edward II and his supporters. It's in the far northeast of England. It's only about 20 miles south of the border with Scotland. And I've already said that the Scottish border at this time is a very vulnerable place because the Scots are rallying under Robert Bruce and could be coming south at any time. Thomas already owned this estate. It had been part of the estate that he'd inherited from his father, Edmund Crouchback, but he'd never really done very much with it. And it's not very close to other estates. It's an outlier that Thomas's land holdings were a huge swathe of the Midlands and South Yorkshire. And he owned a lot of other castles. I've already mentioned some of ours. His most prominent, his most important castle is actually not an English heritage one. It's in the town of Pontefract in Yorkshire. That really would be regarded as his base. So Dunstanborough is way out on a limb. It's way out to the north. And surely in building a castle at this point, at this time, it's about getting away from the centre of things, giving himself a bolt hole to which he might be able to go and retreat afterwards, and also to boost his own presence in this outlying estate of his. Now, We know that he's building it by the spring of 1313 because there is one single document, one single account surviving in the National Archives, an account of the Earldom of Lancaster in a whole variety of places that actually describes his building works at Dunstanborough. I think it's the first time that the name Dunstanborough actually ever appears, that there doesn't seem to have been any great settlement there. And it's a few miles away from the centre of the estate that he had there, the village of Embleton, from which is still one of the places where, if you want to, you could walk from Embleton to Dunstanborough across the fields. It's actually a rather beautiful walk. But Embleton is the centre of things. But he doesn't build his castle in the centre of Embleton. He builds it out right on the coast on this deserted headland that seems, before he built the castle, actually to have been laid down as fields. And what a castle it is, that even in ruins, it's absolutely huge. It's the biggest castle in Northumberland. And it takes the form, really, most of it, as a sort of wall that goes around, as it were, two sides of a square. And the sea is the other two sides of the square. So it cuts off the headland from the land. Now, in the first account, there was one rather mysterious entry that talks about digging a ditch to be filled with water that was going to be very, very deep. I think it was something like 18 feet deep, but it wasn't really that long. And that ditch actually still exists for a rather pathetic, very short stretch inland of the ruins of the castle at the bottom of the hill on which the castle now stands. And this is how I got interested in Dunstanborough, because in about 2004, I got involved in a project with a number of landscape archaeologists led by an old friend of mine, Al Oswald. We'd actually been students together. And if you're listening, Al, hello, I hope you're well. Al doesn't work for English Heritage anymore. But the work that he did with his colleagues in landscape archaeology was truly revolutionary. And it actually changed the way that we think about not just Dunstanborough, but a whole number of other castles. And much of it centered around this ditch, that they wanted to work out why this ditch protected a rather pathetically short stretch of the castle's perimeter. But I mean, otherwise you just walk round it. And as they were studying the whole of the landscape, including the castle itself, but its surroundings, they found a couple of things that were truly shocking. First of all, they found that though it's actually not particularly prominent now, there is a whole outer bank and rampart that runs around the whole of the outside of the castle, protecting a much, much bigger area than just the stone ruin that we see at the moment, pretty much doubling the size of the castle. And clearly that was some kind of outer enclosure. But then around the outside of that, where there is this short ditch, what they found is that the ditch was only one part formerly of a much, much larger chain of water that to both north and south of the ditch, there were freshwater meres fed from freshwater streams. And what that tells us is that the castle was actually completely cut off by water, something that had been specifically engineered, that channels had brought water from freshwater springs and had formed this artificial lake that turned the whole of the castle, including this lost outer ward, into a very, very big island. It's a quite dramatic change from what we have now, which is just the ruins standing on the top of their hill against the sea, actually to have all of this surrounded by a body of water. It suddenly transformed the whole conception of the castle. It made it just huge, absolutely colossal.
Yes, and it really changes the complexion and construction of the place. I must say that having seen some aerial pictures and some drone footage, I did sort of think to myself, oh, that seems a bit flat down towards that sort of bottom left-hand area. Perhaps that might have been submerged at one point. And lo and behold, you've described that it was, according to the archaeologists. So,
and they found something else as well that was quite interesting from the Middle Ages, that on the beach, some distance in front of the gatehouse of the castle, they actually found the remains of a stone jetty or dock sticking out into the water. And so the possibility that actually many of the people who went to Dunstanborough, perhaps Thomas of Lancaster himself, the intention would be maybe that they wouldn't go by road, that they would actually go by sea. And it was rather striking that this jetty was bang in front of the gatehouse, absolutely in a line with it. Now, the gatehouse is something that I need to mention because it's far and away the biggest and most impressive ruin that's at Dunstanborough. The curtain wall, otherwise, it's not that high. It's probably something like 20 or 30 feet high. And it's got rectangular towers at intervals going all the way around. The towers are actually quite small. But then at the southwestern corner is this absolutely huge gatehouse. It's got two D-shaped or rounded fronted towers on either side, and very clearly it had at least three floors in it. And I got very excited about this because I love buildings archaeology. And mercifully, though it's very ruined, enough of it survived that actually you could reconstruct all the lost elements. And very clearly, as well as being a powerful building, it was actually quite a comfortable and luxurious one. And I was able to work out that on the top floor of this were some very, very fine looking rooms with beautiful high windows, nice fireplaces, good provision of latrines, and coupled with documentary evidence, it was quite clear that it was on the top of this gatehouse that the hall and chamber where the Earl Thomas of Lancaster would have lived actually were situated. And in doing a bit more research around gatehouses, what I found is that the things that it looks most like are gatehouses in some of the castles that Uncle Edward I had built in the late 13th century. Now, some of these, sadly, are not in English heritage castles. They're actually in castles run by our sister organisation, Cadw, in Wales, places like Harlech Castle or Beaumaris Castle, where the gatehouses are not just places of strength around the entrance to the castle. They're also fine and luxurious accommodation blocks as well. And clearly, Thomas of Lancaster had looked at this as a pattern and said, OK, I want something a bit like that.
It sounds like it's a bit of a status symbol for him, particularly as it's right up there in the top right-hand corner of England, so to speak. And it's a real bastion of potential personal power for him. Would that be right?
Yeah, absolutely right. Status symbol is bang on. And it's important, I think, that we keep this in mind when we try to work out what Thomas was trying to do. We've already said he wanted to get away from Edward II and the court down in Westminster. And I suppose I need to answer the sort of elephant in the room question, which is, well, hang on, it's right next to the Scots border. And we know that the Scots are around this time massing to make trouble. In fact, 1313, we know that the castle is under construction. What happens in 1314? The Battle of Bannockburn, which the Scots famously completely trounce an English army. So this is a time when the border is a very vulnerable state. Can't we imagine the castle as part of the defence of the border? Well, I don't really think that you can, and for a number of reasons. First of all, actually, a Scottish army coming south doesn't have to go through Dunstanburgh Castle. You just go past it. It's stuck out on this quite remote headland out towards the sea. So it's not well placed at all. It would be very, very easy to get round it, and they did. The great gatehouse is glaring, you know, outwards. And which direction is it glaring? It's glaring south. The Scots are that away. It's actually not in any way designed as part of an effective defence against Scotland. Just about more credible might be that it was somewhere where the people of local towns and villages could go and shelter when the Scots came from them. And that might be the reason why this enormous outer enclosure was created, just actually as somewhere where livestock could be pastured. But I think there must have been something else going on.
Even then, any fleeing villagers would need to have boats in order to get to the castle and inside it, surely.
Well, some of them would come by boat. Some of them doubtless would come over the fields. But, you know, again, I think having somewhere that's a little bit more handy for settlement, that might have been more appropriate. So Al and I and various others got into some conversations about what was the castle all about. We're not the first people that have ever considered this. There was an absolutely magnificent 19th century historian rejoicing in the name of Cadwallader Bates, who wrote enormous monumental history of Northumberland. And one of the things that Cadwallader Bates had picked up on from his historical researches was, you know, he suggested that there's something of an Arthurian overtone around Dunstanburgh. An Owl, I think it was, who first said, well, hang on, what about the Isle of Avalon, the place where Arthur is going to go away, from which he will come back when people most need him? Now, doesn't that sound a bit like Thomas going off in a sulk, hiding in this remote place, Dunstanburgh, waiting for the call when he will come back and save the country? And initially we thought, well, that all feels a bit far-fetched. But then I came across something rather, frankly, rather barking, which is that Thomas was clearly in his time an enormous sort of political wheeler dealer. And at certain points, Thomas did get into correspondence with people in Scotland. Sir James Douglas, who's a great Scottish military leader, corresponded with Thomas. And get this, Thomas used a code name. He called himself in French, Roi Arthur, King Arthur. So he says to the Scots, write to me under the name of King Arthur. Then thinking a little bit more about, you know, Arthurian legends, would they really build castles to evoke an Arthurian legend? Well, yeah, they would. We have already...
They did it in Cornwall.
They did it in Cornwall. My good friend Michael Carter did a very well-loved podcast talking about another obscure earl, Richard Earl of Cornwall, who built Tintagel Castle because of the legend that Arthur had been conceived there and that Tristan and Isolde had carried out their intrigue in the place at Tintagel, and he had evoked this with a castle.
And that's on a headland which is surrounded by sea, or it was at the time.
It's terribly like it. Now, I have to say, I mean, I was interested in Dunstanburgh Castle first, but it really coloured my thinking about all of this when eventually I got to come and play with Tintagel Castle a bit. Already at that point, I was starting to become a believer. And other castles work like that. Caernarfon Castle, another one of these Edward I castles in Wales. It imitates fantastical features from the architecture of ancient Rome, and it's probably connected to a legend in Welsh mythology about an ancient emperor. We know that Edward I had commissioned the building of a round table in Winchester Castle, and he had rebuilt the tomb of Arthur and Guinevere in Glastonbury Abbey. So this family, they've got form for putting their money into re-evocations of the Arthurian legend. Is it possible that Dunstanburgh Castle was actually a bit impractical because they were sort of living in this sort of strange fantasy world of, you know, Arthurian legends, and even imagining themselves as part of the Arthurian legend? Well, you know, I've got to be honest, the information about this. It's not a vast amount of information, but it does exist. And I regard it as actually really quite suggestive.
I agree. I think it's a very important part of the story. Doesn't Thomas Earl of Lancaster, the creator of Dunstanborough Castle, also almost see himself as a reversion of Simon de Montfort, who was also an upstart nobleman?
Yeah, he was. And think of Kenilworth Castle, where Simon de Montfort had owned that castle and now it belonged to Thomas. And what does Kenilworth Castle look like? It's surrounded by an enormous freshwater mere. Well, is it just possible that Thomas was building Dunstanborough as the Kenilworth of the North, as his very own sort of homage to Simon de Montfort? I mean, Thomas knew very, very well that, I mean, tragically, this involved Simon's death, but that after Simon had died fighting for baronial reform at the Battle of Evesham, some of Simon's supporters had gone to Kenilworth and had their last stand against the royals in the centre of this enormous mere and the great siege that had taken place there in the 1260s. So, I realise at this moment that I am being possibly over-imaginative, but I did think at the time when casting around, you know, I think this actually fits quite nicely with the culture of the time and the psychology of some of these baronial figures that are building their castles. And I personally feel quite convinced that something like that went into the mix for the building of Dunstanborough.
I agree. I think it's a very persuasive argument. It's also worth probably mentioning that Simon de Montfort was a real person. What sort of time period? This was a few generations back, wasn't it, in the 1200s?
Yeah, it was. I mean, you know, Simon de Montfort was the person who had tried to do to Henry the Third, so two generations before, what Thomas of Lancaster was trying to do to Henry III's grandson, Edward II, thinking himself as the powerful leading voice in a party of reform to try to cut down the excesses of royal government as they perceived it and to bring good order to the kingdom. Very clearly, that's what Thomas thought that he was doing at this point. So actually taking an interest in the connections between himself and Simon, you know, notably some of these great castles that both men had owned, must be actually quite a powerful motivation for him.
You said earlier at the start of the podcast that you didn't think that Thomas Earl of Lancaster had an eye on the throne, but now it sounds like he might have actually done.
Well, no, I still don't think he had an eye on the throne. I don't think any of these people want to displace the person who wears the crown. What they want to be, I think, is to be the power behind the throne. And they're very resentful of other people who are the power behind the throne. And they reserve the right to be publicly very critical when the person sitting on the throne behaves in a way they don't like. I think that's what this is all about. If I've got this wrong and Thomas wanted the crown, his self-delusion must have been enormous, because one of the things that Thomas doesn't seem to have had is a talent for people management. He seems to have been pretty, pretty dire. And, you know, even associating himself with a cause that lots of other barons could rally behind, he seems to have been jolly good at alienating them. What happens, though, is that inevitably things start to go wrong. Edward II gets some new favourites who are called, rather confusingly, there's a father and son with the same name, Hugh de Spencer the elder and Hugh de Spencer the younger. And they're no friends of Thomas of Lancaster. So he and his friends start another rebellion, but it doesn't go at all well. Lots of their supporters start to defect towards them. And it finally comes to a head in 1322. And at this point, I need to read out a little bit of one of the contemporary chronicles. And apologies that this is quite long, but it's going to mention Dunstanborough. So the scene is, the rebellion is going quite badly. Thomas and his friends are in his big castle at Pontefract in Yorkshire, and they're trying to work out what they're going to do next. The chronicle, by the way, likes Thomas of Lancaster. He calls him a good earl, and he thinks Thomas good, Edward II bad. Anyway, this is what he says. The good Earl Thomas of Lancaster, Humphrey de Bohun, Earl of Hertford, and the barons that were with him took counsel between them at the Friar's Preacher at Pontefract. That's the Dominican friary in Pontefract in Yorkshire. Their common assent was that they should all go to the castle of Dunstanborough, which pertained to the earldom of Lancaster, and should abide there until the king had forgiven him his ill intent. But when the good Earl Thomas heard this, he answered in this manner and said, "My lords, if we go towards the north, men will say that we're going toward the Scots, and we shall be held traitors because of the distance between King Edward and Robert the Bruce that made himself King of Scotland. Therefore, I say that for my part, I will go no further into the north than mine own castle of Pontefract." When Sir Roger Clifford heard this, he rose up anon in wrath, drew his sword, and swore by Almighty God and by his holy names that unless Thomas would go with them, he should be dead, and that he would slay him there. The noble Earl Thomas was sore afraid and said, "Fair sirs, I will go with you whithersoever you lead me." They went together into the north and had with them 700 men at arms and came to Boroughbridge. So there they are. We've just had a nice example of Thomas's rubbish person management. Basically, he can't work out what to do until someone draws a sword at him. And he says, "Okay, right, we will go and hide in Dunstanborough until this all blows over." But they're heading north through Yorkshire. They don't get very far. They go to Boroughbridge in North Yorkshire. And there they encounter a royalist army, including certain defectors from Thomas of Lancaster, and Thomas of Lancaster's army are soundly beaten. Thomas himself is discovered apparently hiding out in a chapel. He's captured alive. He's brought to York, humiliated, according to the sympathetic chronicler, by being pelted with snowballs. He's put on trial in his own castle at Pontefract, and that trial is very embarrassing for him, that apparently the whole matter of his possibly treasonous correspondence with the Scots come out, and he is mocked as King Arthur most dreadful. So you know, everyone's saying, you know, you're going to get yours. And indeed, he's taken out from Pontefract Castle, and outside the castle is beheaded. Rather similar, one would have to say, to what had happened to Piers Gaveston. And certainly a number of the chroniclers believed that Edward II, who wasn't there for any of this process, was finally getting his revenge for Thomas's part in the death of Piers Gaveston.
I see. So all the sort of threads of the story kind of join up at this particular point.
I do. So Thomas is dead. Thomas's faction has already largely fallen apart. Thomas's estates are confiscated by the king, and Dunstanborough passes through a few years of actually being a royal castle before eventually a later king decides that he will make his peace with the heirs of the House of Lancaster, and it's restored to the Earldom of Lancaster, which later becomes the Duchy of Lancaster. And that's actually how it had remained, you know, right through the remains of its history. And it actually goes through some quite illustrious times afterwards. Some later Dukes of Lancaster, John of Gaunt, who is the father of King Henry IV, John of Gaunt actually is in charge of Dunstanborough Castle, and he does quite a lot of impressive building work there. And in the 15th century, Dunstanborough Castle, together with Warkworth and Alnwick and Bamborough, actually plays a very important part during the Wars of the Roses. There's some very important fighting on the northeast border between the houses of York and Lancaster around Dunstanborough. So actually, some of its greatest days are yet to come. But clearly, this story is telling us that finally it was going to be used for the purpose that probably is what Thomas had always intended, as the bolt hole that he would finally hold out in and be the great lord. But he didn't get that far. His army was intercepted in Yorkshire, and he came to the most ghastly of ends.
What's the moral of the story then, if this were a Shakespearean play called Thomas, Earl of Lancaster, would you say? Would you say that's still not a time to challenge the king?
Yeah, I'd say that's probably right. I mean, Edward II's revisionist historians have always been interested in Edward II's qualities, but I think it's fair to say that Edward II was not in any way a successful king. But it must be a testament to Thomas's own fairly poor qualities in some ways that he wasn't able to hold together a coalition big enough to challenge even this quite weak king. Something I've never forgotten is that when I was first starting to get interested in Dunstanborough, naturally, I read the guidebook that English Heritage had at that time, which we've subsequently rewritten. And it had some quite memorable remarks in there. It described Thomas as a thoroughly repulsive person. And at another point, it said he had all the psychological penetration of a rhinoceros, which is the kind of language that we're not really allowed to use in guidebooks now, but it stuck with me forever. And whether or not there's any fairness in that, clearly Thomas actually just was not the kind of person. He wasn't charismatic. He clearly didn't have the powers of leadership that were equal to the point. But I would say that this is telling us that the roles of castles in politics and in culture are actually very, very broad. That much as we would like to think of them as only really coming into their own in times of military emergency, Dunstanborough clearly is doing something else as well as that. And that is a revelation to me that I've later been able to carry on into some of my other work at some other sites. I found it fascinating. Mm-hmm. I do have to say there's a brilliant postscript to do with Thomas of Lancaster. This story is very medieval in so many of its details. We've had skullduggery, we've had murder. But
yes, this is the thing that intrigued me as well.
I think that the most amazing thing about it is that this uncharismatic man, people tried to make him into a saint. Now, one of the sort of funny things about the way that, you know, we know about all of this is that there were attempts to create a pilgrimage cult around his tomb. He was given a quite quick burial in the Blackfriars at Pontefract, near to the place where he'd been executed. And people were claiming that miracles were taking place at his tomb. This seems to have alarmed Edward II's local authority to the extent that they actually closed the church at Pontefract to people, at which point the cult then broke out in the centre of London. Again, I'll come to a contemporary chronicler who says, at this time, God wrought many miracles in the church of St. Paul, so St. Paul's Cathedral. At the tablet there, which the said Thomas made in remembrance that the king had granted and confirmed the ordinances made by St. Robert of Winchelsea, Archbishop of Canterbury, and all the great and wise men of England, to the great profit of the realm, in which place the crooked were made straight, the blind received their sight, and the deaf their hearing, and other beneficial works of grace were openly shown. I mean, this is crazy that people were going into St. Paul's Cathedral, looking at some tablet on the wall where someone had written down about these ordinances, these restrictions of the authority of Edward II, and had said, just looking at this caused me to have a miracle. I mean, this is absolutely crazy. And it certainly bubbled on and came up a bit more after 1327, which is when Edward II himself died, at which point some bodies within the church actually started to write a liturgy for church services based around a cult of Thomas of Lancaster. Now, I'll just read you a bit of text from this office of Thomas of Lancaster, because it's actually very telling. It begins, "Rejoice, Thomas, glory of chieftains, the light of Lancaster, who by thy death imitates Thomas of Canterbury, whose head was broken on account of the peace of the church, and thine is cut off for the peace of England. Be thou to us an affectionate guardian in every difficulty." Mm. Now, Thomas had a very good Christian name. He has the same Christian name as Thomas Becket,
yeah,
about whom we have spoken. Thomas of Becket had opposed Henry II and had been killed for it. Thomas of Lancaster had opposed Edward II and had been killed for it. So they were very clearly, they were trying to turn him into Thomas Becket. And I should say that actually in 1322, we're only 2 years after the church in England had just received its latest saint, another Thomas, as it happens, a stroppy bishop of Hereford, Thomas of Cantilupe, whom the Pope in Avignon had just made into a saint. So stroppy people called Thomas are looking quite good in the church at the moment. And clearly some people thought, yeah, Thomas of Lancaster would work quite well. The cult never took off. I don't think the miracles were ever regarded as in any way convincing, but nevertheless, it never totally went away. And possibly the sort of last reference to it is just around the time of the suppression of the monasteries, when Dr. Leighton and Dr. Lee were going around on the orders of Thomas Cromwell, sorry, another stroppy Thomas, but this time not a saint, going around the various monasteries and compiling evidence for misbehaving monks and dodgy miracle cults. And when they got to Pontefract, they went to the Blackfriars and they listed under the heading Superstitio, superstition. Here they hold in veneration the girdle or belt of Thomas of Lancaster, effective for women in childbirth, and his hat for those with a headache. So yeah, the last reference of Thomas is a battered old hat and a belt, one used for men with a headache and one used for women in childbirth.
Yes, it sounds to me that any attempts to make the miracles sound legitimate are as a result of a desire to maybe bring back another noble person who can challenge or at least influence the king. It seems to be more less of a miracle cult and a saintly cult and more of a kind of political cult, to my mind, at least as a modern person.
I have to agree with you totally. I have a feeling that, you know, some people must have taken an enormous pleasure at the thought that royal authority could be challenged. I mean, as it happens, in this instance, challenged very unsuccessfully. But the idea, the fact that Thomas had paid for this with his life, the word martyr could be used and was used. And
rhymes with Lancaster in a way.
that's truly dreadful. I think one thing that you do also have to acknowledge about all of this is that, you know, I said at the beginning that I wasn't quite sure about the relationship between Edward II and Piers Gaveston, and I'd stick by that. But I think as time went on, people did start to interpret that through the lens of homophobia. And I think by the time you get, you know, a few decades afterwards and people are talking about the cult of Thomas of Lancaster, there is an element about that, because there are certainly some poems that are later set to music, which actually do read about all of that, that Thomas is regarded as a figure of enormous virtue because he had got rid of this Piers Gaveston, who was regarded as dreadful. Mm. And this, to a modern readership, actually feels deeply shocking and very, very unpleasant. Whether it was actually something that actual strict contemporaries would have seen at the time, we simply don't have the evidence to know. But it certainly does seem to have coloured interpretations afterwards.
Mm. Just lastly, just quickly wrapping up, for people who want to visit Dunstanborough today, obviously there's that quite long walk. You can park up in a village. The site's accessible, but as long as you've got some walking boots and a good bit of energy to get there, I suppose.
Yeah, it's absolutely that. You've got to go over some fairly bumpy ground. Sometimes bits of it do get quite wet and muddy. And as I would say, I mean, just, you know, going inside the walls, you know, please do, and do climb if you can to the top of the gatehouse, because the views are absolutely brilliant and you get the wind in your hair and you really do feel like you're stepping into England's story. It's just fantastic times. But if you've got time, do have a wander around the landscape, which is all open to the public. The site, actually, we manage it, but it belongs to the National Trust. It was given to them earlier. So the coastal path for Northumberland is open, and you can walk all the way around it, walk through the bits where the mere formerly was. And actually, it's a great, great place to explore. I think it's still, for people who enjoy some of the more open air of our sites, I think Dunstanborough Castle would be a very hard one to beat. I always feel so much better after I've been to Dunstanborough because I know I've had an adventure.
I think there's a line in Jane Austen's Persuasion where it says, "The sea air always does good."
Yeah, I've got to say I've missed it. It's been a while in lockdown when it's not been possible to get to Dunstanborough, and it actually is one of the sites that I think about most, actually, that it would just be lovely to go to. But it's a fantastic area. I mean, some of our most wonderful sites are there. I mean, as a castle specialist, you know, I'd have to say, yeah, please do go to Warkworth, which is absolutely lovely. But Lindisfarne Priory is up the coast. You can actually see the inner farm from Dunstanborough. You can see Bamborough Castle on its rock from Dunstanborough. It's a really, really great place to explore.
And Alnwick Castle's nearby as well. So there's plenty for a local or a tourist visiting that area to go and see.
Yeah, there certainly is. And there's good eating there too. But it is truly a wonderful part of the world.
Well, I don't know whether we've fallen in love with Thomas, Earl of Lancaster, exactly, but we've certainly cast a light on his complicated and interesting story. And I think people will get an appreciation for the castle itself and of him and of Edward II and all the other characters involved in this story as a result of what we've just discussed. So thank you, Jeremy, for talking us through it.
Thanks very much. As ever, it's a pleasure to get some of this exciting but little known history off my chest. So thanks very much, everyone.
You've been listening to the English Heritage Podcast. Next week, we'll look at a part of England's steelmaking past.
It's not just the factories or the ports of cities like, you know, Newcastle or Sheffield, but it's also the graft and technical expertise of tiny communities like Derwentcote that put places like the northeast of England at the forefront of the Industrial Revolution.
Thanks for listening.
See you next time.